Welcome. This is the Water Policy in the Trump Administration panel. All panels at SEJ seem to be like the children of woebegone, above average, but I think this panel, I know this panel, is going to be above average. We have three terrific panel members here to talk about water policy in the Trump administration, how it's playing out at the federal level, and changes we see at the state level, and how that interaction is taking place. To my left here, we have William Andreen. He's a law professor at the University of Alabama, and back in the 80s, he was a lawyer in EPA Region 4 in the Reagan administration. Next to him, we have Brent Fuel. He's the founder and chair of the Earth and Water Group out of D.C. It's a lawyers and a consultancy. And he was in the Office of Water in the Bush administration, 2004 to 2007. And at the end of the table, we have Ramez Ziadeh. He is the acting...
Executive Deputy Secretary.
Acting Executive Deputy Secretary for Programs at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. And so what that means is there's drinking water under there, there's abandoned mine reclamation, there's dam safety, wetlands, rivers, Chesapeake Bay. So a lot of water areas are under that domain. I want to start with this idea of cooperative federalism, which is one of the things that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is adamant that he wants to focus on in his time at the EPA. So he said, rule of law, cooperative federalism, public participation. So cooperative federalism is something that both Bill and Brent have written about, talked about. So I want to start with this question so we have a baseline here of what the cooperative federalism relationship means in practice.
Okay, I'll be a little basic, but hopefully that will bring everybody up to speed. If I'm not okay, I'm sorry, and if just move me off stage whenever you want to. It's difficult to talk about cooperative federalism because there's really no good definition of it. There are at least three different forms in practice around the world today. One form is simply a system where the state governments, state agencies are predominant. There is some help from the federal entities, the central government, for financial help, technical support, but basically the driver's seat is in the hands of the state. That's basically what we had in this country in one form or another for decades up until the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972. And it did not work very well. Another model is what they have in Germany, where the central government sets the standards, but all the enforcement and implementation in terms of issuing permits is in the hands of the respective states. That works well in a few German states, doesn't work very well in a number of other German states. The system we have in this country for the Water Act and Air Act and RCRA as well is a dynamic kind of cooperative federalism. It's a system where there's not clear duties on both necessarily, but everything is sort of intertwined and overlapping. But nevertheless, the federal government clearly in this system in the Clean Water Act is the senior partner. And that's the reason for a whole lot of reasons. First of all, there was a fear that Congress had of everything going down to the lowest common denominator, the race to the bottom. And clearly, a number of representatives and senators talked about that in 1972. They talked about the fact that certain industrial powers have a great deal of clout at the state level. Some congressmen said, yeah, these state agency officials in many cases have a lot of integrity, but they get beat over the head back home. In addition, a lot of our pollution problems are interstate in nature. We share rivers, we share lakes. And there is the economy of scale. No sense in doing the same thing 50 times over. And in many instances, state agencies don't have the resources and technical expertise to do some of the more complicated tasks. So it makes a lot of sense for the federal government to have basically the driver's seat. And that's what Congress chose to do in 1972. In addition, they were acting against the historical record. The states had been in the driver's seat for at least 100 years prior to the passage of the Water Act. Some states did a number of innovative things. Water quality standards had their start in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut back in the 1920s. They were pretty rudimentary, mostly aimed at protecting drinking water. But nevertheless, they innovated. Pennsylvania innovated in the late 1940s and created what we now know as uniform effluent limitations. Again, they were pretty rudimentary, requiring industry when they discharged conventionals to basically do what we wanted publicly owned treatment works to do. And in the 1960s, states like Oregon instituted a permit program. So all of these were innovations that we built upon in the Clean Water Act. But most states, of course, hadn't done these kinds of innovations. In 1965, when Congress required states to start doing water quality standards, only 10 states had them. And by 1971, most of the states had not adopted satisfactory water quality standards. That's, you know, when you look at the record at the end of the 60s, it was pretty dreadful. Three-fourths of all industrial discharges were raw, received no treatment. We were losing the battle in keeping up with sewage treatment at the public level. We were losing over 500,000 acres of wetlands every year. Over 500,000. And we were having new records set every year on fish kills in American waters. So it's against that background that Congress passed the Water Act in 1972. Okay.
All right. So thanks for the background on cooperative federalism. We'll get into like what's happening now. Brent, I'm going to bring you in. You were in the EPA Office of Water. So two-part question here is how you see this cooperative federalism when you were in the office, and then what you see as Administrator Pruitt's goals of getting what you think his idea of cooperative federalism is today.
Yeah. Yep. Just to context for my background, I was the Deputy Assistant Administrator, so the number two in the Office of Water in the Bush administration, overseeing both the Clean Water Act and the Safe Drinking Water Act programs. And what I can tell you is even during the Bush administration, EPA, you know, is a very strong regulatory agency. That's its mission. That's what it does well. There was an effort even in the Bush administration to do some things innovatively. And there was obviously some challenges. Many within the agency, you know, did not always agree with the Bush administration policies, particularly with oil and gas. I think what you've got now with this administration and Administrator Pruitt and the president are policies that are even more an anathema to the agency and many of the career staff. And obviously you're hearing a lot about it. But what I would say is, you know, I've actually predicted that we will see, and this may come as a surprise to many of you, I've gone out on a limb and said I think we will see actually more environmental protection, either because of this administration or in spite of it. And the reason I say that, and I have long been a proponent of the states, when the states assume greater responsibility, and there's always this push-pull with the states and the feds, when that relationship between the federal government and the states is healthy, you end up with more environmental protection. And I can tell you, even when I was there at EPA, there's always this tension between the states. States not doing enough, or EPA wanting the states to focus on different things. But I think what you're going to have in this administration, what you're really seeing is Administrator Pruitt and his team saying, listen, we believe in the basics of environmental protection. I mean, nobody wants to go back to polluted waters and polluted air. There obviously are some concerns about rollbacks, and I appreciate those concerns. But ultimately, what this administration wants to do is say, states, we're going to give you greater flexibility. We want to return even more power back to you in order to have greater flexibility and focus on the priorities that you believe are important for your states. And I will tell you, coming from the agency, it's a wonderful agency, and I have utmost respect for its mission and the career staff there. But I think what you will see is many states, and how many familiar with Environmental Council of States, ECOS? you have the secretaries that get around, and it's absolutely fascinating to go to these meetings and watch EPA top leadership and the state top leadership have these discussions. Some of the states have always used EPA basically as saying, okay, we have, and talking to their industry and their citizens, we have to do this because EPA is making us. What you are hearing now is many of the states saying, well, geez, if EPA is not going to make us, then we need to step up to the plate. So I think increasingly you're going to see many of the states kind of take the mantle. Now, what I would also suggest is for the states to step up and do more of what they need to do, there has to be the funding. It's going to take several years because many states' budgets have been cut back over the years. It's going to take more, several years for these states to basically have the adequate financing and structure in order to kind of fill that gap where EPA is basically pulling back and saying states take the mantle.
All right. Thanks, Brent. Well, let's bring in the state perspective here. At the end of the table, we have Ramez Ziadeh, who is in charge of some of these programs. From your perspective in Harrisburg with the DEP, what is this relationship? Do you think you have, if federal funds are cut, do you have the ability at the state level to fill in this gap? And use the mic,
sure.
Please.
All right. So, again, you know, some of the proposed cuts will likely impact how we implement some of our programs, you know, at the federal level.
Which cuts?
We receive a variety of different federal grants annually that support some of our enforcement, inspection, permitting activities in the clean water program and the drinking water program and brownfields, environmental cleanup program, and also radiation protection. So any cuts, any federal cuts would have some impact on how we implement some of those initiatives and some of those programs.
Just so we're clear, sure. Impacts meaning what? Not having the staff to do?
Correct. We have a certain number of staff that are supported by some of these federal grants. So cutting these funds will impact our staffing complement to a certain extent. The majority of our staff are funded through the general fund, but we do have some staff that are supported by these federal grants. So cuts to these programs would impact our staffing resources and would impact how we basically ensure that, you know, proper compliance is handled adequately and so forth. Our agency over the years too endured some cuts at the state level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, now again, we are trying to try to do more with less, you know, to try to achieve the mission of DEP. So we're continuously looking for ways to improve our processes, you know, take a fresh look at how we conduct business, how we roll out permit application forms, SOPs and so forth, too, and again, to identify opportunities to improve the permitting process for both applicants and reviewers without really compromising the protection that we want to achieve.
Yeah, so Brent, you laid out what is an optimistic vision of what might happen in the next few years. But for, say, a state that doesn't have the will or the budget authority or the, you know, the willingness to raise funds where EPA is not there, are they left to hang? So what is the result for a state commitment across the board that's the same?
Well, Brett, first of all, I think many states, and correct me if I'm wrong, the funds from the federal government probably are what, constitute 20% of your budget? Is that right, 20-30%?
Give or take.
Okay. So it is a significant portion of state budgets. So what you're going to see is cuts along the margins for that. So, you know, many states like Pennsylvania are going to have to do more with less. I think what you're also going to see is the administration encouraging states to find smarter, better ways to do environmental protection and giving states greater latitude. Like I said, there's times historically where EPA has been has been very directive and basically not allowed the states to focus in areas where they thought that they could make progress. So I think you're going to see a much greater positive relationship between the EPA and the states and a willingness and a flexibility to again, allow the states to focus on those core areas for their states.
So more with less, what does that mean? Do you see any examples of states that are doing
that? Well, let me give an example. I tell you, Pennsylvania and particularly Pittsburgh was a perfect example of cooperative federalism where I started out as a young lawyer here in Pittsburgh at Jones Day as a Superfund lawyer. And Superfund lawyer was, full employment opportunity for lawyers. So you spent years, decades, arguing over cleaning up sites and the liabilities associated with cleaning up abandoned industrial sites. Well, you had them all over Pennsylvania, brownfields. And so what you had is an initiative, actually, that got started in Pennsylvania where you had all these idle lands that were sitting idle because of the potential liability to landowners and to potential buyers in development. And Pennsylvania basically moved forward on a risk-based cleanup program to clean up these sites and mitigate and minimize the threats of liability to those that would come in. So, there's so many ways that the states can move forward where there are unfortunately some inadvertent impediments and barriers to environmental protection. Let me just give you one more example. When I was in the Bush administration, we pushed forward what was called the Good Samaritan Initiative that was to clean up abandoned hard rock mines. And we have abandoned coal mine watersheds that are just ravaged even in this area with abandoned mines and particularly out west in the hard rock mines. Well, this is where states can step up with EPA being a strong federal partner and saying, listen, we want volunteers. We want to encourage you all to go in and clean up these watersheds. Trout Unlimited and many other organizations want to go in and clean up these watersheds. But because of the Superfund liability and Clean Water Act liabilities and the threats of these liabilities, there's actually a reluctance to go in and fix these problems for fear of liability. So this is where the federal government can actually come in and say, listen, we want to remove some of these barriers to allow you, the states, watershed groups, and people within your state to go in and clean these things up without fear of liability. And I could go on, but that's an example.
Yeah, thanks. Bill, does this more with less work in your
opinion? Well, I've heard we can do more with less before. I heard it from Ann Gorsuch in 1981 as Clean Water Act enforcement was going down 50%. They were responsive to state government. What you heard through the grapevine was if a state chose not to enforce, EPA was not supposed to question that. So EPA enforcement fell in the Water Act area by 50%. And it took a long time once Ann Gorsuch had resigned and Bill Ruckelshaus came back. It took a long time for Ruckelshaus to get it going again because we had lost a lot of staffing and a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge. And if you look at the historical record, states don't pick up, for the most part, the gap. State enforcement fell at the same time. It also fell in the mid-1990s when there was another hiccup in federal enforcement and fell in the early 2000s, I believe. The state budgets, they run from 25% to 65% dependent upon federal funding. So it's as high as 65% in some places.
Do you know which states?
I don't have that with me right now. But there is a report coming that came out of ECOS about 6 months ago with those numbers. And the administration was proposing this year a 45% slashing of grants to state governments, which would affect their ability to conduct inspections and do enforcement. At the same time, EPA enforcement was supposed to be cut 25%. And at the same time, the administrators proposed to withhold the $25 million a year that goes to the Justice Department for enforcement actions under Superfund. That's 69 lawyers and support staff. And if you lose that, you're going to lose a lot in ENRD, the Environment and Natural Resources Division. There's no discretion. They have to defend cases brought against the United States. And there's going to probably be a lot of them. in the next few years, which means that if you're going to cut out 20% of the funding for the department, or the division rather, you're going to see a loss of maybe 40% of enforcement effort at DOJ. So, you know, it may not come to pass. Congress may not allow some of these things to occur. But the cutting of the budget for the Superfund lawyers at EPA is a matter that's in the administrator's discretion, unless Congress were to forbid it.
Right. Yeah, so if you want to respond to that. Okay.
If I can respond, and Bill's right, well, I mean, what's going to happen is there's always this game that's played with budgets. Where you have OMB, obviously we have Mr. Mulvaney, who's very aggressive in trying to reduce, to make cuts. And then Congress restores those. And I will tell you, there's obviously, even within the government, federal government, there's obviously a disagreement. And Scott Pruitt, you know, wants more money to go to Superfund cleanups. I mean, that's one of his highest priorities. I'm very close friends with the leadership of the administration at DOJ and EPA, Susan Bodine, who these are very serious professionals that are very serious lawyers and take the rule of law very seriously. So I think sometimes we forget, even though we see this resetting of the balancing between the federal and state governments, I think what people may miss with this administration is they take the law very seriously. They take process very seriously. And I guarantee you that this administration does not want to have another Flint on its hands. I mean, the last few administrations, even the Bush administration, was derelict and going out and enforcing against many of these communities where you have serious noncompliance issues in the Safe Drinking Water Act and Clean Water Act. And there's been, we could talk a long time, been a lot more focus on Clean Water Act than there has been the Safe Drinking Water Act. I think what you're going to see with this administration is focusing on public health. There are thousands of community water systems in significant noncompliance, which are putting people health at risk. And I think you're going to see a focus on that with this administration.
So there, let's talk about what has been proposed and what you think journalists should pay attention to. So there's the Waters of the U.S. rule, which the Trump administration has proposed to repeal and then replace with something else. There's a rollback of coal ash disposal. There's power plant effluent rules that have been tried to suspend. There are Congress, through the Review Act, nixed the Stream Protection Rule, which was on mining issues. So of these actions, and there it's a whirlwind for journalists, what in this swirl would you say is most important to focus on from each of your views?
Go ahead.
I can touch briefly on the Waters of the U.S. rule. Mm-hmm. There was a proposed rule back in 2015 that the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a stay on. That rule basically proposed to expand the definition, the pre-2015 definition of the waters of the U.S. The current rule that was published in the Federal Register and the public comment, I believe, ended in late September of this year, basically proposes to rescind that 2015 rule and recodify the definition to the pre-2015 definition. So that proposal doesn't really impact the state of Pennsylvania. We take jurisdiction over waters of the Commonwealth, and waters of the Commonwealth are the jurisdiction that we take on waters of the Commonwealth is beyond the federal jurisdiction on waters of the U.S. So we regulate larger areas, streams, floodways that are not necessarily regulated, and wetlands as well, that are sometimes are not regulated under the Clean Water Act. So this proposed rule right now doesn't really create a conflict in how we administer our state programs that are really more protective, and it doesn't conflict with how we implement the delegated federal programs in Pennsylvania.
So one insertion here, Brent mentioned maybe more focus on Safe Drinking Water Act. Pennsylvania DEP, the EPA earlier this year and in the last few years has been focused on better drinking water enforcement and more emphasis from Pennsylvania DEP on drinking water issues. With the new administration, do you still see the same engagement with EPA? Is the same pressure from the EPA to reform how drinking water is regulated in Pennsylvania?
I believe so. I mean, we work really closely with EPA Region 3.
Yeah.
We have a really good relationship with them, and we work with them on the big cases, and they are interested in making sure that the citizens of Pennsylvania do receive good quality water, drinking water that meet the standards.
Yeah, the Waters of the United States rule is an extremely important issue coming up. You're all probably familiar that the administration is pursuing this in two steps. First step is to rescind the 2015 rule, and then the second step is to revise the old 1975 rule, which they hope to reestablish as modified by the 2008 guidance and the Rapanos decision and Swank. Yes.
So what is the U.S. rule? Extremely complex legal language. Can you tell us in a sentence or two why it's important?
I'll try. As a result of the Supreme Court's rulings in Rapanos and Swank, we were left, and the 2008 guidance, left with an untenable situation. In most instances, the controlling opinion in Rapanos is Justice Kennedy's opinion, which follows clearly the Swank holding, which says that there has to be a significant nexus between an upstream tributary and what a traditional navigable water is, a significant nexus in terms of chemical, biological, or physical integrity. Now, between 2008 and 2015, every single time you dealt with a headwater, okay, could be a very large stream, but it's right above where the stream is navigable. You had to do a case-by-case determination of jurisdiction. It's inefficient, time-consuming, especially with the budgetary constraints. The agencies don't have people to go in the field all the time. It's confusing to the industry. Probably a lot of situations where there should have been an assertion of jurisdiction wasn't made. And it cost way too much money. And you can see what's going to happen. It's a perfect storm if in a situation where you have straitened budgetary situation. Excuse me. Kind of feel like Prime Minister May now at the Conservative convention. But at any rate, the new rule was designed to make it simpler, more efficient, more consistent. Because basically it was reliant upon peer-reviewed science.
The rule being the
2015 rule, yeah. Based upon peer-reviewed science, 1,200 peer-reviewed articles that was gathered together in another peer-reviewed piece of science and then reviewed yet again by the Science Advisory Board. And it basically established the premise for how all these upstream tributaries and adjacent wetlands, neighboring wetlands and bordering wetlands and contiguous wetlands, are all part of one hydrological system. And that whatever happens to one of those does, in fact, impact downstream navigable waters in terms of biology, in terms of the physical flow, and so on and so forth. It's easy to understand. Okay, these waters provide flow. They provide habitat. The wetlands help clean up the pollution and siltation, and we can go on and on and on. So it made life simple. If you go back and you rescind it, you're going to have a case-by-case significant nexus determination every single time you have a possible permitting situation upstream. It's an untenable situation, and yeah, that's okay.
So this is very interesting to me, this argument. That Administrator Pruitt has said regulations should be regular, and that the whole purpose of his operating principle is that the regulated community should know what's expected of them. And the argument that the 2015 Clean Water or Waters of the U.S. rule was designed to make things more regular, and now it is being overturned and being replaced with we don't know what. You're making the argument that that creates more uncertainty if you have to go case by case, wetland by wetland. Is this regulated or not? Do you share that opinion, Brent?
Yeah, I do. But I guess Bill and I would agree on one thing, that clarity is absolutely essential. But what I would say, I was at EPA when the Rapanos decision came down and spent a couple of years trying to make sense of a 414 Supreme Court decision and put together the guidance on this. So it's a very complicated issue. And the issue that you have right now is science is way ahead of the law. And so, you know, what we see is, and I agree with Bill that, there are connections, between waters in the environment. You know, ecology has many different connections. But what you're going to see with this, and I fault the last administration, there is an absolute need. We cannot regulate wetlands and waters through guidance. It's just too important of an issue. But what we do need to do is get the rule right. And, I love Nancy Stoner, and who was at EPA, who kind of shepherded the rule, the 2015 rule. But in my view, the agency overreached. And there's gray areas here. And so what you saw is a tremendous political backlash by the farming community and other communities where many ditches and isolated wetlands were going to be subject to jurisdiction. And what the Obama administration did, which I think was the right instinct at the last moment to try to save the rule, was to put in limits, boundaries beyond the traditional navigable waters. So, for those of you who are not Clean Water Act lawyers, essentially you have to have some type of significant nexus to traditional navigable waters. It's connected to the Commerce Clause. That's the authority. Constitutional authority is the Commerce Clause. And so the farther you get away from those traditional navigable waters in isolated wetlands that may be 10, 15, 20 miles away from the closest stream or river that you can float a boat down, the question is, what is the role of the federal government in regulating that large Pocosin or that isolated wetland? And I think in my view is the federal government, there are many waters that the federal government simply has no role in regulating. And I think we heard from my colleague from DEP is that the states have their own authority to protect those waters, and in many cases, states are doing so. So for journalists that are here, the things that you're really going to want to watch out for as this plays out is the scope of the new rule over ditches and wetlands far remote from traditional navigable waters. That's, ultimately that's where that's where this rule basically fell down was, we have ditched, we have diked, we have done things across the landscape. So you will have waters and wetlands that were otherwise, isolated and not subject to federal jurisdiction. Now subject to federal jurisdiction because there's been some type of excavation that connects these water bodies. And so that's the complexity. It's politically very difficult. And not only politically difficult, but scientifically very, very complex. So that's where the courts are going to wrestle.
Right. And the Supreme Court is hearing challenge to this case next week, October 11th.
On a very narrow legal issue. Yeah. So.
On which court gets to hear this, basically.
Yes.
I assume there's going to be lots of audience questions, and we can get back into waters of the U.S. through audience questions. But I want to go to Ramez here before we go to the audience. For what interactions or what are you looking for in the next few months, next year, in this interaction between EPA and Pennsylvania, what should journalists be looking for this cooperative federalism, state-federal interaction? Budgets or decisions that the state is going to have to make about where to put people or allocate funds?
I mean, we still don't have a budget in Pennsylvania, and we don't really know how the federal grants, they're going to play out, so I really cannot comment on that at this point. But we're doing the best that we can with the resources that we have right now. Mm. No, that's kind of a vague answer, but that's the best that I can offer at this point.
Maybe a Chesapeake Bay question. Pennsylvania is part of the TMDL going to the Chesapeake Bay, and those interim reports are due. And it's my understanding that Pennsylvania is not meeting its targets. Mm-hmm. What interaction do you see between EPA and the state on Chesapeake Bay?
Well, I mean, again, we're trying to implement, or the we're trying to meet our obligations. as far as the Chesapeake Bay is concerned. And again, it's been a little bit challenging with the resources that we have, but we certainly are working to do the best that we can to basically meet our obligations.
So what? So resources and challenging, which resources and what are the challenges?
Well, I mean, we have some staffing resources. We have some funding resources.
One of the biggest challenges for Pennsylvania is obviously agriculture, and the runoff that's impacting the bay. As long as the agriculture is not regulated under the Clean Water Act, that's going to continue to be a problem.
Yeah. But that's one area where the Clean Water Act gave the states flexibility. When it comes to their best management plans under Section 319 for waters that are impaired by non-point sources like agriculture, they had the choice. They could either go with a regulatory program or they could go with a voluntary program. We have more or less a regulatory program, and it's hard to count them up, roughly 8 states more or less. Some of the states that contend they have a regulatory program have never enforced the law, so I would dare say it wasn't regulatory. In Pennsylvania, for example, there was a requirement that farmers have some sort of management plan, and that was in the Clean Streams Act, I believe, in 1960. But according to state officials, as late as 2012, they had never enforced it. Now, I'm not criticizing the department, but I come from Alabama, so I have no standing to criticize any state agency whatsoever. But it's a real problem. That's where they had flexibility. They had flexibility to establish environmental flows in their water quality standards, to have a kind of a varied flow in streams that would represent or mimic the hydrological cycle. And almost no states have done that. And to get that done someday, it's going to have to be written into statute by Congress, which tells you some story about why I suppose federal government should be in the driver's seat. States have always had the flexibility to be more stringent. So Pennsylvania has the discretion to have more waters regulated than the Clean Water Act would require. They could regulate groundwater, whatever. They can establish tighter effluent standards. They can have mandatory limits on agricultural discharges. But we haven't seen much of that. In Alabama, they've defined waters more broadly than the Clean Water Act, but in Alabama and many other states, 25, maybe 30 states, they have forbidden by statute or by rule the state agency from going any more stringent or any more broadly than EPA would require. So, I mean, they might want to, but they're forbidden by state law from doing it.
All right, we've raised a lot of different questions, different acts, different legal questions. We're going to turn to the audience. I assume there's going to be a lot. The ground rules for this are SEJ members get first shot at questions. Identify yourself. I will repeat your question into the microphone so that the recording equipment can catch it. Keep your questions short. No harangues, no soliloquies, no manifestos. I will cut you off if you go. You can, but we want to keep things snappy. So I saw one back here. So the question is states that are prevented by statute from setting stricter standards, how do you protect against that?
Yeah, it's a fair question. And what I would say is, again, getting my start as a young environmental scientist doing wetland delineations and permitting in the eastern half of North Carolina, I can appreciate those concerns. So with obviously important, you have a big agricultural issues there. I will tell you, I am not a defender. I'm not of this administration, the policies. I think their instinct is right in many cases. I think that they can improve what they're trying to do and incentivize states to do more. and I am not supportive of rolling back all these regulations. What I would say is there are gray areas, and just stepping back from your question, I'd like to get to it. There are gray areas in federal law right now that EPA has basically assumed a position over the years and kind of filled that and perhaps pushed out too far to the outer limits of what their authority is. And you're seeing a backlash, and you're seeing a desire by many to rein that back in and, again, give the states a little bit more authority. There's no doubt that some states like Alabama are probably going to take advantage of that. But I am optimistic. I think, you know, with folks like you and your organization, there are – you know, the environmental laws still have citizen supervisions. We still have very sophisticated watershed groups and citizens in these states who are going to continue to be the watchdogs. And ultimately, the courts are going to decide. I mean, I was in the Bush administration and helped push forward 10, 15 different regulations. A number of them have been overturned by the federal courts. So I suspect that you will see many of these issues kind of play out in the courtroom. But in the interim, I have great comfort in knowing that the watershed groups and the litigants, you know, are watching very closely what happens at the state level. I understand the frustration and the concern, but I'm not so pessimistic. I really do believe there's opportunities for states to kind of make progress, despite the fact that EPA is kind of stepping back. So,
question here.
Hi, my name is Donna Morelli. I'm with the Bay Journal, and I cover Pennsylvania. And my question is for everyone, really, that directed at DEP. I do a lot of work with your PIO there. EPA has been the force in making sure that Pennsylvania gets their regulatory stuff done, basically. And they have been writing warning letters, including threatening to take over primacy of the safe drinking water program in Pennsylvania because DEP is so understaffed, underfunded. And I appreciate the task you folks have at hand. Mm-hmm. And I understand that this is coming from another level of government where we still don't have a budget. Our legislature does not want to raise taxes, does not want to raise fees. I've been told by legislators that I've interviewed personally that that's DEP's problem. We are behind federal safe drinking standards as to the number of people that we have to inspect our public drinking facilities. How are you going to do more with less? I mean, how much more less can you have? 40% of the budget.
So the question is, EPA can exercise a strong hand and force action for the states. If they go away, what happens?
Yeah. Because it's not happening already. I mean, basically, these warning letters are out. Right. Nothing's happened. Nothing's been fixed.
Go ahead.
Take Pennsylvania. I'll talk about what's happened at the federal level.
I mean, no, I appreciate your concern, and like we share your concern as well. It's just that right now we don't have a budget. We really don't know what our budget's going to – like we don't really know we have fee packages in the works, but again, they have to go through a legislative process. So it's not all up to DEP. A lot of these things that you bring up are we're under the mercy of the legislators a lot of times. So we're very active in trying to make the case for safe drinking water and for public health and better environment. But again, you know, this is not all, it's not up to DEP to get more. I mean, we do make the case for it. We fight for it. But we're at the mercy of legislators. So, and at this point, I really don't really have any information as far as if DEP is going to get additional funding to hire more people or, but then at the same time, we're working on some fee packages to try to supplement our revenue to be able to hire more staff.
Let me just speak to the Safe Drinking Water Act quickly, because this is an area of considerable focus for this administration. So, Administrator Pruitt has made water infrastructure a top priority, and I'm in the thick of things working with the White House and also members on the Hill to find ways to, there's not a pot of gold out there to pay for all these things. So one of the most significant things that's even impacting Pennsylvania is you have a lot of small systems that don't have the resources and the money, and there's not the political will to go out and enforce against them, either at the state or federal level. Do you want to follow up on that?
Add, we're not even talking about enforcement. We're talking about having the bodies to go help.
I understand.
Yep. An entire state.
Fair enough point, but here's the problem. Again, this is directly related to community water systems and drinking water. We're having just tremendous problems across the U.S. I mean, Flint, I will tell you, was just the tip of the iceberg. And I've been in this, you know, in the water sector for many, many years, and been involved in overseeing probably over 1,000 water systems. What you're seeing at the federal level, we have far too many systems that are in non-compliance. And so there's an effort right now to try to figure out, well, we don't have enough money to fix these problems and pay for inspectors to go out, so let's figure out a way to consolidate and regionalize these systems. So there's a real effort right now. Both the Democrats and the Republicans on the Hill are very interested in finding out ways that we can incentivize voluntary consolidation between a lot of these rural communities and systems where you have significant non-compliance. And that's happening right now. So I appreciate the fact that, you know, we may not have the budgets, but there are other ways to accomplishing some of the ultimate goal that we all have in mind.
And
just briefly, there are similar problems on the sewage side. We have significant noncompliance, especially by many small systems that can't manage to operate right properly or to repair problems, and they have low tax bases and are in many instances hostage to one large industry in their little rural community, which overloads their system. And it's a significant problem all over the country. But I did want to say that on the water pollution side, there have been petitions filed, and most of them had good grounds, I believe, to remove the permitting authority from 30 state agencies because of their budgets, because they have, in many instances, no enforcement policy, because they don't, in an enforcement action, collect the benefit economically from the polluter that they enjoyed as a result of their violation. All kinds of discontinuities between federal enforcement practice and what's done in many, many states. So an EPA cannot grant them. EPA has no budget to run a state enforcement program or to run a state pollution program. So all they can do is inspect, monitor, cajole, jawbone, and so on. In the Chesapeake, and their only authority on non-point source pollution eventually, since they can't enforce non-point source regulation in Pennsylvania, is to cut back on the point source community, to force tighter permits or to enforce against smaller infractions. But I don't see that particularly happening as a result of these WHIPs today. It might otherwise have happened. EPA doesn't want to do it, but it has very few things in the toolbox because there is no – non-point sources are left out.
Just as an aside, Brent mentioned consolidation of systems, which is an interesting story nationally. California passed a law 2 years ago allowing the state to force consolidation of water systems so a larger, more financially stable system can absorb a smaller neighboring system. The state has forced one consolidation to this point and has voluntarily encouraged a couple dozen more. But Kentucky in this Appalachian region is another state in which consolidations have been carried out quite frequently. And the number of water systems in Kentucky has shrunk considerably. I don't have the numbers, but Kentucky is a leader in consolidation.
Can I also just add, you know, Bill and I have kind of been a little tough on agriculture up here, non-point sources. But what I would say is there's a real opportunity, and I've been working for years on trying to start market-based approaches, water quality trading. In fact, helped Pennsylvania get its program started as a young lawyer back in the 1990s to basically encourage point sources to work with non-point sources to reduce the cost of compliance but also get more pollution reduction in the watershed. So there's a tremendous opportunity. Pennsylvania's program, it's been around a while. Need some work, but I hear some skepticism over here, a little chuckling going on. So at least he's not throwing things at me as I say this. But in any event, there's opportunities to make progress on those market-based approaches too.
Right. Other questions? Up front here.
Kyle Bagenstos from the Bucks County Courier Times. I covered some of the WOTUS issues in Pennsylvania a little bit, and some of the arguments I heard for why it would be detrimental was that there might be some kind of dual enforcement capacity. In other words, the EPA still would have a role to play in enforcing headwater enforcement. So I guess I want to hear mostly from, is it Mr. Z? So, but also from Mr.
Fuel, just like gasoline.
Right. So, to what extent does the EPA play a role in enforcing Clean Water Act violations in the state? Do you partner with them? And given the outcome of the LOTUS, could that have an impact on some kind of regulatory in the future? And also, broader, does the EPA and other states have?
So, well, question is on enforcement of Clean Water Act and what effect WOTUS rule would have on that.
Sure. So impacts on waters of the U.S. are regulated under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act by the Army Corps of Engineers. So these impacts not only require state permits, but also require federal permits. So we have a system in Pennsylvania. There's a joint permit application process for surface impacts on waters of the U.S. and waters of the Commonwealth. So the applicant comes into the state to apply for these permits, and then we coordinate with the Army Corps of Engineers on the federal permits that are required for those types of projects. So yes, the Army Corps of Engineers, they have regulatory authority and enforcement authority.
Did it extend to the headwaters? Would the expectation be that they would?
Yeah, as I indicated, I don't know if I said this prior, but under our current definition, our current jurisdiction in Pennsylvania of water, on waters of the Commonwealth, the jurisdiction extends the headwaters, including intermittent and perennial streams that are defined very, very well defined in our statutes and regulations.
I think, Brent, there's also a question about...
I was wondering...
Yeah, the agency, EPA, will still have its authority to overfile in cases where and pursue independent prosecution, civil and criminal, if a state doesn't do so, and they will continue to do so. So, knowing it depends. It has to be federally jurisdictional. So there's always that question: yeah. Is it subject to federal jurisdiction? If it's not, then they won't. That's subject to the state.
And they routinely do that on a regular basis on the clean water programs in Pennsylvania.
Just one follow-up. The way Congress created the Water Act was to have redundant enforcement authority. It was very intentional to have overlapping enforcement power. So EPA was given tremendous enforcement power administratively, civilly, criminally, along with, you know, working with justice. States were given, recognized their authority to enforce state-issued permits. And then citizens were given authority as well to file citizen suits, although the courts have created a lot of obstructions for citizen suits over the years. But the reason that Congress gave, if you look at the legislative history, was we know that certain branches of government will from time to time not have the will or the resources to enforce or enforce adequately. So we want to create other actors who can come in and step in and take the pressure. Which is one reason why it's so terribly important to have citizen suit enforcement today. Because state agencies, I mean, some state agencies may well be in a position resource-wise and politically to enforce vigorously. Many won't. Alabama, there is no general funding of the agency. None. Their whole budget comes either from EPA or from the permit fees they charge. So it's a very, very small program.
Questions? Yeah.
I have a question. I'm not in D.C.
First, identify yourself.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. I'm Kathy Clabby. I'm a reporter with North Carolina Health News. And I'm not in D.C. I'm in North Carolina as well. But I've been reading, of course, about what's been going on in D.C. And one of the things that I read is that the secretary, recently, some journalists were looking at who he was meeting with. And it tended to be a lot of corporate people and no environmental representative. So I'm wondering, you know, when you talk about sort of new creativity, which voices are going to be heard and which won't.
Yep.
I promise I won't go on for too long. My question is specifically, whose voices are being heard in this debate about federal oversight of the kind of water rules we're talking about, and whose aren't? And So who has more influence and who has less? And are states who are challenging this administration legally, like yours is, are they being heard or are they being shut out?
We do. So it's,
the question is, who has influence? Who is getting to meet with people in power? Who's shut out?
Specifically, not just sort of generally. If you could sort of tell me the names of organizations that have more power, more voice now than they used to.
So first of all, on waters of the U.S., I will tell you, I've been somewhat critical of the administration and even Administrator Pruitt on who he's willing to meet with. I will tell you, he's, and you've probably read about it, and it's true, there's been a lot of threats on his life. Anytime he goes anywhere, there are protests, and so he has, you know, from all observation based on administrators that I've worked with, he has really curtailed a lot of his public speaking simply because of the response to things that are going on in this administration. I have encouraged them, and I will continue to encourage them to meet with all environmental groups. He has met with two environmental groups so far in person, one of which I helped to set up that up. But he is communicating on a regular basis with environmental groups. Not always in person, that's on the schedule, but there's phone calls, there's meetings with groups like Environmental Council of States and others. I would also say on the waters of the U.S. That there are currently stakeholder meetings going on, so there's 10 stakeholders meetings that have been scheduled over the next few months, and these are, you know, with industry groups, with environmental groups, with the hook and bullet groups, and, you know, we distinguish between the environmental groups like Sierra Club and the hook and bullet crowd like, you know, Trout Unlimited and Ducks Unlimited. And so there are a number of those stakeholders that are going to have direct input. And let me also just say, there are two EPAs. There's a political EPA, there is the top leadership, and then there is the career staff who will continue to be there. And so there's sometimes, you know, you hear shades in the paper of the politics that are going on and the bad stuff that's going on. But I guarantee you, if you go to EPA and you talk to a number of the folks there, they are seeing some positive things that are happening. It's not all positive for many of them who want more kind of top-down, you know, regulation. But with respect to other opportunities to do things differently and innovatively and focus on technology and accelerating the pace of cleanup, you are seeing things that are changing. And I'll just also put a plug in for Superfund. I mean, the administrator is interested in getting results done and accelerating the cleanup of a lot of these Superfund sites that have languished for years, impacting communities, environmental justice communities. And so there is a real opportunity to accelerate. And what was controversial, and which a lot of the career folks didn't like, was the administrator actually took greater control over the decision-making on what sites to clean up and how quickly to clean them up. And frankly, that was a good thing. For many years, you know, a lot of these sites that have languished, the cleanups have languished. There needed to be something to spur and speed up the cleanup process. So, you know, many of us read things in the paper, and it sounds like it's all doom and gloom at the EPA, but quite frankly, I see things differently. So, again, I've been somewhat critical of this administration on who it's willing to meet with, and I will continue to encourage the administrator and those in the administration to meet with environmental groups and hear from all groups.
Yeah, but the administration, man, and maybe it's not the leadership at EPA, but the budget the president submitted would have cut the Superfund budget from about $1 billion a year to $700 million. So that's a cut of 30%. And then cutting out perhaps the lawyers at DOJ doing the enforcement, I mean, it's not necessarily going to help the Superfund program. But.
Yeah, identify. The question is about funding for Superfund and proposed budgets and congressional budgets.
Yeah, I may be, I don't know if I'm double counting or not.
Yeah.
If they're, whether or not the money was coming from the trust fund or whether it was coming from the operating fund, what EPA has been surviving on in the Superfund program has generally been the annual appropriations ever since the special tax on the chemical industry and the petroleum industry went out the window and when Newt Gingrich was running Congress in 1995, or at least running the House. But there still is a trust fund that still does get some cost recoveries and any penalties that might be assessed under the Act, so that goes into the trust fund as well. But I would assume, yeah, the $25 million is coming out of the trust fund in some way, since the appropriation is to EPA, it's not to the Justice Department. But I don't know for sure.
I mean, and the question to you would be, again, the lessons learned, sorry.
Yeah.
How do you exactly do that?
Well, your point about the budget, I was involved in these budget games when I was there. So the administration says we're going to cut 30% in this area, and Congress restores it. You see the concern. Obviously, there's concern with Republican members on the Hill as well as Democratic members about too much cuts. So many of these programs are going to be restored. And ultimately, you'll see perhaps reductions of 5-10%. You know, an agency that was, when I was there, 18,000 is now down to 15,000. It had a budget of $8.2 billion. You may see a budget of $7 billion. So ultimately, the agency is going to be able to do more with less. And in fact, you know, the idea is, and I will say, too many people in D.C. There really needs to be more boots on the ground, and you know, at the state level and in the regions. So you know, I don't see these budget cuts as necessarily a bad thing. So.
Yeah. Just one follow up: the budget in 2010, which was about 30% larger than it is today at EPA, was in real terms, adjusted for inflation, smaller than EPA's budget in 1977. That's before RCRA was implemented. It's before Superfund was passed. It's before, you know, we had lots of amendments doing a lot of new things under both the Water Act and the Air Act. So, yeah, it's a tremendously underfunded agency, in my opinion. On the science side, you know, the proposed budget was to cut it in half. And then to ignore climate science and to ignore the hydrological cycle on waters of the United States, it's kind of interesting.
Other questions? In the back, yes.
My name is Jeremy Torsnick. I'm with the U.S. Department of Justice Environmental Crime Section.
Well, first, journalists get first crack at questions. So are there any media reporters who have a question before that? Yes. So is there a concern about having two tiers in the U.S., those that can afford or want to pay for environmental protection and those that don't? Open for anybody.
Oh, it's a risk. There's a risk.
Yeah, there's been a two-tier system for years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the history of our country. But the states, I wouldn't say necessarily is always the wealthy states that are in the one tier. It varies from time to time. And it depends on the political atmosphere and who's running things in the state capital. And how wise and knowledgeable the state agency is. So it varies from time to time, but there's always been a handful of states that have been real leaders. California, for example, with air pollution back in the late 40s and 50s into the 60s, and it continues. A lot of states on the climate side with their portfolio standards, and in the Northeast we have a trading program that we, you know, probably should have at the federal level, but it passed the House, didn't manage to pass the Senate in 2010, and it's been off the agenda for political reasons ever since. There is a two-tier system, and that's one reason why you have to have federal minimum, because we're all American citizens, and we're all entitled to the same amount, at least, of minimal health and a healthy environment, no matter where we live or no matter how wealthy we are.
Any other reporter questions? All right, yes, from DOJ.
In light of your discussions about the water in the United States rule, do you anticipate, other than permitting of weapons, do you anticipate greater challenges to EPA and state efforts to permit facilities that discharge to streams? You may be familiar.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
The question's about permitting for discharges to streams.
Yeah, right. Right. Right.
Then aren't there going to be companies,
yep,
some who have not yet sought permits, who will argue, we don't need it, but we have a pipe, yeah, going right into the stream. Sorry, it's not a part of the United States, and before you require us to get a permit and to be subject to your limitations, you have to show that this is a jurisdictional water. One.
Right.
Two, in an enforcement situation, where you're bringing a case, be it civil or criminal, against the company, say, yeah, but you know, the permit was improperly issued because we're discharging it into a stream that is not a water of the United States, and you can't show sufficient downstream impact,
yep,
by virtue of the new rule to, yep, to enforce any permit issue.
Right, so the question is about this certainty, and does it leave room for infinite delay? Yep. And legal battles.
First of all, thank you for your service at DOJ. You know, your section, criminal enforcement section, is a very fine section. My partner, Doug Parker, was the head of EPA's Environmental Criminal Investigation section. You probably know Doug. So you guys have a hard job, but do it very well. There may be cases. I think we're talking about dancing on the head of a pin on some of these. There may be some cases in the arid west where you have permits that discharges that are not jurisdictional, where, and that happens right now. You have a number of wastewater facilities, domestic and also industrial, that discharge into arid areas where they're not subject to federal permits. But I do believe that in most cases, and this is based on experience of actually working with a lot of these industrial facilities, there's going to be very few facilities that I could think of that would not be subject to federal jurisdiction because of the lack of a NPDES permit. I mean, you certainly could challenge a permit, but many of the industrial facilities we're talking about has significant flows. So you have effluent-dominated flows that eventually reach traditional navigable waters. So I really think there's going to be very few situations. You may have. I'm not going to say it couldn't happen, but I do think that in most cases, you're really not going to see the lack of jurisdiction or facilities falling out of jurisdiction based on a NPDES permit being improperly issued. So just my thoughts.
Right. Then I've got two final questions here, one for Ramez to bring in some more Pennsylvania state perspective. And that being, we've heard about concepts of more of less, declining budgets. You've talked about challenges in Pennsylvania with the state not passing a budget. And in those circumstances, how does a state department, do you get to decide where to allocate certain funds? And if you have that discretionary authority, how do you make those choices? How do you pare down if you have to?
We prioritize public safety. So if we have a permit that we have somebody applied for a permit and that permit is needed to protect public safety, or if we have to look into a complaint or a situation that involves public safety, that is our number one priority. So protecting public safety is our number one priority. All right?
So public safety.
So that could be a permit, that could be an inspection, that could be like a violation inspection or an enforcement case or anything that involves, that puts the public at risk, is our number one priority.
So you have to, yeah, so thinking this through, you have dam safety programs, you have,
correct,
abandoned mine reclamation,
yep,
you have,
yep,
wetlands,
yep,
permitting,
yep,
so you have to look at those programs and say,
that is correct,
permitting versus enforcement versus inspecting a dam versus, mm-hmm, you know, charging for,
like, water. For example, if you have an unsafe high hazard dam somewhere, mm-hmm, and it has some significant issues and we have an application on file to rectify those deficiencies, we would prioritize the review of that file, of that application, to ensure that the work is going to get done, mm-hmm, quickly, promptly, to protect downstream life, you know. So that's kind of an example.
Right. And so we've heard federal budget, or federal funds making up a good portion of state budgets. When those monies come in, are they earmarked for certain programs, or do you have the ability to say, we are needing money for this area, and have the ability to divert that there?
The federal funds?
Yes.
No, they're earmarked for certain program areas right now.
Yep. And do you see, so if there are cuts in those funds, are there certain areas in which there is more cuts or less? So for certain program areas?
One of the biggest grants that we get is the 106 grant. That's several million dollars annually. And that supports a number of staff. Obviously, that would be a direct hit on staffing resources if that gets cut. We do get a variety of different federal grants that support programs, state programs like, the Chesapeake Bay implementation grant money that goes towards good projects that would help us meet our obligations in the Chesapeake Bay and so forth. So it depends on the grant program that's getting cut and what that program supports.
All right. Then our last question here, we have room of reporters. What federal policy, federal action, state-federal relationship do you think should be reported on that is not getting the attention that it deserves? Or, lacking that, of this flurry of activity from the federal level, what is most important to focus on? What is the sound and fury, say, a president's proposed budget that never gets touched because Congress does what it will? Where's the just noise, and where's the real action at for reporters?
I would like to see some folks reporting on actual enforcement levels. And I think, it's a little early. Early in the administration, it doesn't count because things are continuing for a while. But as we get deeper into the administration, that is a time to take a look at how many administrative penalties are being assessed by EPA, how many compliance orders are being issued by EPA, how many referrals of civil cases go to justice by EPA. As well as looking at the state level, and you will not see many civil referrals, but you'll see administrative penalty actions and administrative orders, but not many civil actions. But to see, they will probably go down almost in lockstep, as Administrator Ruckelshaus was fond of saying, the state agencies need a gorilla in the closet, and EPA is that gorilla. They have to blame that enforcement case on somebody. They can blame it on EPA. They would say it's going to be worse for you. Another grill in the closet are the citizen suits, because one way to get the state of Alabama to do something on enforcement is to notice a citizen suit. And as soon as you do, they try to preempt it by bringing their own administrative action. It's like night follows day that happens, at any rate.
Yeah, I'm going to end on a note of agreement with Bill here. So enforcement is absolutely critical, and I agree that you have to have a strong EPA, strong enforcement to continue to keep industry honest. Lots of industries are proactive. But what I would also say, don't look, in a year at the number of penalties and civil violations, because the bean counting hasn't always worked. What I would really urge us all to look at is the performance. And you talk to my colleague Doug Parker, who was in the enforcement section of EPA for 25 years. He says, listen, we've got a lot of bean counters that are being forced to do cases, but it's really not changing culture. What we have to do, what EPA has to do, and we have to do as a society, is change the culture of these sectors. So it's not only enforcement, but it's compliance assistance. And what I would say is, particularly on the drinking water side, for years we've been focused on streams and critters, fish, surface water quality. What we really need to focus on over the next few years is drinking water and the sad shape that many of our rural and small communities are in, and the assistance that they need. So you can't simply bring traditional enforcement actions against a lot of these small communities, because it just doesn't work. So ultimately, enforcement is about changing culture to do the right thing.
We've got about a minute.
I really don't have anything to add, so I thank everyone for giving me the opportunity to participate in this panel discussion, and if anybody has any questions for me, they...
Okay. The corner in the hallway. Questions. Yeah, thanks. to the three panelists. Give them a hand.
Thank you.